This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Shug McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you as always. And you're listening to the show live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or you're tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the program, and you're doing that on our HRN website at horseracingradio.net. Really excited to have you along for the next hour as I continue with our Breeders' Cup theme. If you remember last week, we focused on the Breeders' Cup on all of our shows, of course, and then brought you exclusive radio coverage of every Breeders' Cup race here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And today's guest, believe it or not, is actually making his second appearance on Trainer Talk. He first joined the show December 12th, 2018, but when you saddled the winner of the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies, it absolutely warrants a second visit.
VeQuist in fourth, they're at the quarter pole. Simply Ravishing is fifth, and she is still running some six lengths from the front to the top of the short stretch. Day out of the office, opening up on a three-length lead as they turn for home. VeQuist up the inside. Princess Noor is still there on the outside. Girl Daddy still far back with Simply Ravishing. VeQuist is coming up the rail. Here's VeQuist up the inside. Now to challenge Day out of the office, and VeQuist just keeps on running. VeQuist, Joel Rosario, to win the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies.
Kurt Becker with the call. That's the way it sounded at Keeneland last Friday. And please join me now in welcoming the trainer of VeQuist, Robert Butch Reed Jr., to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Butch, appreciate the visit.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yep.
Yeah.
Exciting weekend.
How about that for a little trip down memory lane, huh?
Yeah, that was great. And I don't know if anybody got a chance to watch it on the helmet cam, which is a really interesting addition they did this year. But to watch it and how tight that hole that Joel sent her up in was pretty amazing.
I will actually go back and do that. I haven't seen it because we were obviously on air, but I will go back and watch that. I know when I got a chance to catch some of the Friday, early Friday coverage, I was watching some of the camera angles that NBC used, and they really took things to a new level.
Yeah, I believe they did. There's endless amounts of things you could watch, ways to watch it. But I didn't get a chance to watch the actual telecast yet, but I'll get to that one of these days, I'm sure.
Well, when you look at some of the numbers that you have put up in your career, and according to Equibase, that win in the Juvenile Fillies marked your 13th Graded Stakes victory. It was win number 794 overall in your career, and stakes win number 48. What a way to reach those milestones, winning a race like the Juvenile Fillies.
Yeah, it was great. You know, it's a thing you work. We've been at it for 35 years, however long we've been at it for. My wife and I and my daughter. So it was to catch it in a race like that, and for the owners, was just amazing.
I remember when you joined me on the show in 2018, and it was right after you won the Remsen with Maximus Mischief, and you were worried about your voice holding up because you said all you had done was talk since that victory. How about now? Have you done plenty of talking since the Juvenile Fillies?
Yeah, that's for sure. There's so many friends and well wishes along the way besides the media stuff, you know, that everybody wants to talk about and be part of it. So it's just a great feeling to have, we've got plenty of sport when we got back here to Philly and everybody was happy and high-fiving. Well, you can't high-five in these days, but everybody was having a great time and wanted to talk about it. So, yes, my voice is starting to wear a little thin, but we'll survive. It's a good problem to have.
Oh, it certainly is. Take me back to right around 3:52 on Friday afternoon as VeQuist comes over to the paddock and then makes her way into the starting gate and, of course, eventually crosses the finish line first. Take me through the moments before the race and then Take me through the race as you're watching it.
Well, I mean, it was amazing. When she came into the belt, to me anyway, I'm sure I'm a little prejudiced, but she won the paddock show to me because when she came into the paddock, she just looked spectacular, and she's always been a filly with a really good head on her shoulder, so she was calm. We had schooled her in the paddock, my wife, Virginia, and Teresa, my assistant, had been up there with her for close to 2 weeks. And when she came into the paddock and her coat was gleaming and all dappled out, and she was cool as a cucumber, where some of the others were acting up a little bit, I felt pretty good right there. So the paddock show was just amazing. And she, you know, amazing filly with a tremendous head on her shoulders. So I was feeling pretty confident that, you know, when you're coming up to a race, that's the kind of thing that you worry about. Almost like you don't have time to worry about the outcome of the race. I mean, is everything going smoothly? Or could we show up for the dance on time? And all the stuff that runs through your head. And actually, I was meeting the owners for the first time, Gary Barber. I had never really met in person before, so I met him in the paddock. So, and we had a nice little entourage. My brother Brian and my daughter Whitney was there also. So it was definitely a high energy feeling, and you know, it was nice. Once we got the saddle on her and things were settled down, it was kind of like my job was done there. And we talked to Joelle a little bit, and you know, there really wasn't much way in instructions on a race like that, and with a rider like Joelle Rosario, I don't know what I could add to what he knows for sure. But you know, it was just an electric feeling for sure.
What a way to get to know Gary Barber and to endear yourself to Gary by winning a race like this for him. And I know that he put a lot of trust in you by keeping the horse with you after the horse was purchased. It wasn't just Gary, it was the other owners too. But they all believed in you. And to be able to hand them that trophy after winning the Juvenile Fillies had to be special for you, Butch.
Oh, absolutely it was. You know, we've had 3 starts together, and all in grade ones, and we got 2 wins in the second. So that's not a bad to start out a relationship. And man, looks to me, well, it should be an Eclipse Award, but I hate to be presumptive on something like that. But, and Gary or Adam Wachtel, and now I just found out that neither one of them have ever won an Eclipse before. So for them, you know,
really?
To show the faith in me, yeah, I was surprised to hear that myself. And to hear, you know, and be able to, and the guys that showed the faith in me for a guy from Philly, it doesn't really come across too many of these kind of horses. We've certainly had our share along the way, but for those guys to give me that kind of an opportunity and be able to pay them back just a little bit was really a good feeling.
Yeah, I know Gary had mentioned in his post-race press conference and even in his post-race interview with NBC, he had mentioned that he now has a farm in Pennsylvania and he has several babies up there that you will be training. And it's got to be nice for you, Butch. I know a lot of times in sports, for example, they say it's tough for a player to always be playing at a high level, looking over their shoulder, wondering if, you know, look, I throw an interception, am I coming out of the game? If I make an error, am I going to be pulled out of the game? You don't have to worry about that now. It seems as if you've got this established relationship and they have such belief in you that now you can just go and train these horses and do your thing and not be looking over your shoulder. That has to be huge too.
Oh, absolutely. Especially with guys with, you know, quality and class guys like they are, you know. So it was, you know, you're constantly rechecking yourself and making sure that you're making the right decisions along the way. And those guys have just been tremendous. They're involved. They like to talk about it, talk about the spots, talk about the jockeys. And they make it so much easier for you, their involvement and their understanding of the sport. So it was a relationship that I think worked well from the beginning. And they do their homework, too. They had researched me, and I hope things had worked out that way. But, you know, for a guy like me to get a horse and, you know, for Tom McGrath to be able to stay in, you know, he's a homebred filly to Tom Bred and from a mare that we built relatively inexpensively down at that Timonium 2-year-old training sale. And having an opportunity to everybody stay involved and go along for the ride is just fabulous. It's just a fabulous time.
Her final running time, 142.30. That's the fastest running of the Juvenile Fillies since Songbird did it at Keeneland in 2015. That's pretty good company there, Butch. But when she crosses the finish line, that moment, what was that like for you? Take me there with you.
It was kind of funny because, I mean, it was wasn't a big crowd there, obviously, but there was enough people there that you could, you know, there was a bit of a crowd. I wasn't staying there by myself, but our whole little entourage, kind of everybody went their separate directions. I know my brother was in one section. I was down past the wire, and I think my wife and daughter were down by the winner's circle. So once I saw her coming through, I started jumping up and down, and people were looking at me like I was crazy, all 300 pounds of me. I think they were more worried than anything else. But and I heard my brother hooping it up, and then that kind of ran underneath the grandstand. And I heard him hooping it up over in the next section, so I ran to him, and we, of course, had a big embrace, and we sprinted down to the winner's circle where the whole other group was standing down there. So for a little while, I felt like Jim Valvano after North Carolina State won the championship, looking for somebody to hug, but we were all running down. So it was just an indescribable moment for my daughter, who's now a 30-year-old pediatrician, but she'd been drugged through our 20 years of up and down the highway between Monmouth Park and New York and Florida, and she had been in 10 or 12 different schools by the time she graduated from high school. So for her to last through all that, and then very fortunately she almost couldn't make it, so I was so proud of the fact and happy with the fact that she made it and was able to enjoy it and sharing it with all of us.
Spectacular to be able to share that with not just your team, you mentioned your assistant Teresa, but your family too. That is just, that's what this sport is all about, and it happened, and the stars aligned, and it came together perfectly. Visiting with trainer Butch Reed Jr. here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton, as you heard, trainer of VQuest, who took the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies last Friday at Keeneland. It was a race you heard right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Butch, I remember... the other thing I remember about that first show when you joined us in 2018 was I asked you if you were superstitious, and you said, not really, a little bit maybe. You said you wear the same tie if things are going well, things like that. And the tie you wore when Maximus Mischief won the Remsen was the same tie that you wore to your daughter Whitney's wedding, and you just talked about her. Was there any significance to the tie that you wore last Friday at Keeneland?
Yeah, I didn't wear a tie. That was the significance.
Well, there you go.
So, yeah. No, actually, I'm not that much of a clothes horse, but they had bought me a new outfit for the spinaway, and then I changed it for the Frisette where we got beat, so I had to go back to the spinaway outfit for the Breeders' Cup. It worked out perfectly. So.
Fantastic. Yeah. So you had confidence in this filly from day one. Obviously, she was beaten in her debut at Parks, but you turned right around and threw her right into the grade one at Saratoga, and she delivered with a huge performance that day. What is it about her that stood out to you and led you to believe that she could be this caliber?
Well, it's her head. I mean, it's all about – I mean, besides being a big, tall, rangy filly with good natural speed, her head is what makes her what she is. She doesn't worry about anything, and there's nothing in a race that is going to discourage her. And when she got beat in her debut, we knew we were way under running her. A race came up going 4.5 furlongs. It was a little bit ridiculous when you think about it, but it was more or less a schooling race. I got to be in there with 7 other horses, which you can't reproduce in the mornings. It's hard to. So that was the idea between for the 4.5 furlong race. We knew it was way under her best distance. She had already breezed 7/8 of a mile in like 125 before I even ran her in that race. So, it was, just a nice setup. And then when, after that race, when Wachtel and Barber got involved, I got to say that they were more, they're more the chance takers and risk players than probably I am. So I may have been looking for a maiden race, and they were in hunting for the spinaway. So it was their push that got us there.
Well, thank goodness for risk takers like that. It certainly paid off, and she became a grade one winner, now a multiple grade one winner. Her next race in the Frisette, she's beaten by Day Out of the Office, and that race obviously proved to be a key race because Day Out of the Office ran a huge race behind VQuist in the Juvenile Fillies the other day. Did you kind of know going in that you had to do things maybe even a little bit differently to turn the tables on her, or what was the thought process going in?
That's a very tough filly, and to get her the second time is quite an accomplishment because she isn't going to give you anything. So, But no, I mean, you know, we had a change in riders. There was nothing personal against Saez or anything like that. But we just felt Joel might be a little bit, you know, in a little bit better position on that one coming around in the next track. But, you know, I thought we were certainly competitive with that filly. And, you know, we had a terrible post in the Frisette. We broke from the one hole in that one turn mile. And I don't think she really got a full chance to show her true, true ability in the Frisette. So we were confident. We were at least competitive with Day out of the office and the, you know, the others. You know, it was the, like a lot of people said, it was the shortest field on the Breeders' Cup weekend, but it was all maybe the toughest field because I believe there was four undefeated horses in there. So there was quite a few accomplished horses in there. And to get the, you know, it was hard to say we were confident, but I knew I had a good horse that was going to run good. So as confident as you can be, I suppose.
Yeah, not only did you have to deal with Day out of the office, but you had to deal with horses like Princess Noor from the barn of Bob Baffert, who had come into the race in top form too. And obviously VeeQuist proved up to the task and then some. When you thought about stretching her out to two turns for the first time, and she wasn't the only one in that boat coming into the juvenile fillies. There were other fillies that were looking to do the same thing. But when you look at doing that, and you look at her pedigree, being by Kentucky Derby champion Nyquist and Breeders' Cup juvenile winner, and out of a mineshaft mare, Butch, that had to give you a lot of confidence that she would handle the assignment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said before, I think it was her confidence in her head that really what makes her what she is. You know, she doesn't worry about anything. So that was, you know, we thought about it. We were between the Alcibiades and the Frisette as the last prep before the Breeders' Cup, and we decided on the Frisette, even though the Alcibiades was two turns, and we, you know, we kicked that around a little bit, but we wanted a nice fresh horse coming into the Breeders' Cup, and the Frisette was just a lot less shipping and a lot less hassle. The Frisette, you know, we're very close to Belmont Park here, so we shipped her up the morning of the race, and she was back in her stall by, you know, 7-8 o'clock that evening, so it was only one day out of her schedule, and it gave us an extra week from the big races you had running and spin away. So that was what went into that decision making process, but also the fact that I was not concerned that she could get two turns. She trains in the morning when, you know, nothing bothers her, and you know, that's what gave me confidence to go ahead and let the Breeders' Cup be our first time around two turn. So, and we were fortunate enough to have it work out.
Folks who were tuned in to the radio broadcast or watching on TV may have seen you in the winner's circle and said, oh, wow, Butch Reed, who's this guy? This must be his first Breeders' Cup win. That's not the case. You've had several greatest stakes winners, as I pointed out earlier, and this is your second win in a Breeders' Cup race because in 2011, when it was at Churchill Downs, a Fleet Again won the Breeders' Cup Marathon that year. So you're undefeated, a perfect 2-for-2 with the Breeders' Cup in Kentucky. You might want to maybe look at moving things to Kentucky.
Yeah, I like that thought. You know, that fact, you know, a couple of people said, well, what was it like? You know, a couple of the interviews were, what's it like to get your first Breeders' Cup win? I said, well, actually, it's not my first Breeders' Cup win, but, you know, I was, as I said, you know, in Kentucky, Breeders' Cup seems to be the way to go. But, you know, they did away with the Breeders' Cup Marathon, so that record doesn't hold up quite as well, so maybe people don't recognize it. But, you know, if you win 2 out of 3 in Breeders' Cup races is a pretty good accomplishment, I would say.
What was different about this win on Friday and that first win back in 2011 with the Fleet Again?
You know, this one was more thought out, and we had, you know, it was with the Fleet Again, we were kind of taking a stab. It was almost the same, though. We had just had a change in ownership. New people had bought him. And actually, my daughter was in college then, and I was up in Boston. She went to Wellesley up in Boston, and we were up there with her for a hockey game when we found out we were getting in. So I had to grab a suit at the Big and Tall Man store up there and jump on a plane to get to Kentucky in time for that race. So, you know, that it was kind of a more spur-of-the-moment thing for the previous time we were in the Breeders' Cup. This one, we had a fair idea of what we were doing, you know, 2 months out, so we had plenty of time to plan and figure out our training schedule and our logistics of getting her down here and getting the people down here to get it done. So this one was more of a much more planned out thing, where the last one was like, all right, let's go. We're going to take a shot. And I guess, you know, both of them worked out, fortunately.
Yeah, it's a great story. And, you know, once you win a race like the Breeders' Cup Juvenile or the Juvenile Fillies, the attention immediately turns to either the first Saturday in May or next year it'll be the last Friday in April, because the Derby is May 1st. The Kentucky Oaks will be run on April 30th next year. And obviously the questions have already started coming. You know, how do you get her ready for the Oaks? Is she, you know, you said maybe an Eclipse Award winner, but now is she the favorite for the Kentucky Oaks? All those types of things. There is a long way to go between now and then. And I know trainers hate to even think about it, but you kind of have to. You have to map out a plan from here, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, surprisingly, I guess it seems like a long way to go from the outside. But when everything kind of settled, Adam and I and Gary had spoken before the race. We had a little bit of a rough outline of, you know, if this happens, this is what we're going to do. But surprisingly, you know, we had decided that we're going to send her to the farm, and that's where she is now. She's down at Barry Eisman's place in Ocala. She actually got turned out for the first time yesterday in the round pen. She's enjoying the sunshine and picking on some grass down there. But amazingly, there's not that much time, because if you want to get a couple of preps in before then, so then you're backed up to making your next start around the first week of February or something to that effect. So you only got about 30 to 45 days where you can, let them down, you know. So, she's going to get a little time there, and I've taken some stalls at Palm Meadows this year. So she'll be joining the group down, a small group I'm going to have down there, and we'll start getting her ready for the probably the Florida races or some sort of preps, which way we're going to go. But, you know, the thought being that I'd like the Oaks to be her third start of the year next year. So you start counting back 5-6 weeks from each of them, and doesn't give you a whole ton of time, actually. So,
yeah, as a matter of fact, we are, just so you're aware, 170 days away from the Kentucky Oaks on April 30th next year. So mark that on your calendar, 170 days to get her ready.
I'll start crossing them off now, I guess. But we've got a good, you know, a good kind of rough plan. But, you know, I think it'll fit her well. And she came out of the race perfectly sound. We actually just ran a whole set. I heard from Dr. Eisman this morning. We ran a whole set of x-rays on her just to be safe and make sure we weren't missing anything. And she's perfectly clean, and she's happy down there and enjoying a little bit of R&R. And we'll get her back to work in 5 or 6 weeks or so.
Yeah, when you had Maximus Mischief, he kind of took the same approach with him. You sent him down there. You targeted some of the Florida races with him, and you were jumping back and forth because, you know, you still have to take care of the operation up in Pennsylvania too. You have your wife, who is a, you know, tremendous asset. You have Teresa, your assistant. How do you handle it from here? How does a trainer, Butch, make all this come together and make sure you're in the right place at the right time?
Well, it's all about your help. I mean, that's you have to rely on them, because you can't be everybody everywhere at once. And I'm very fortunate that my wife, Virginia, is an excellent horsewoman. So I have complete trust in her. And she was actually down there. I didn't get actually to Kentucky till I went down to watch her breeze, you know, in the middle of the week. I think it was Saturday or so the week previous. Then because of the transportation problems, I didn't get down there until Thursday afternoon the day before. So I trust them, and Teresa doesn't, you know, an excellent, Teresa gets on her, and my wife does all the groundwork and the TLC. So you have to trust in your help, and, you know, because you can't be everywhere at once. But I'm going to get to spend some time in Florida this year, because, you know, we're going to have, but only a small string down there. So I still have 25 to 30 to worry about up here. But I'll be back and forth pretty much all winter, I would imagine. So. But you have to trust your help, and I'm very fortunate to have a good squad and a good squad that I don't have to worry about, you know, too much about the parks operation up here. So I can split my time up as I need to.
Yeah, people may not be aware, but your wife has quite the horsey pedigree too, going all the way back to the Great Secretariat.
Yeah, she actually started on horses well before I did, and she worked for Lucien Lauren back in the 70s, and she got to ride the van to down to Laurel with him and Riva Ridge, I believe it was, or something like that, the big horse. And,
wow.
And then she actually she'd been galloping horses for close to 30, 35 years, and, you know, is an excellent horsewoman and has, a lot of experience with horses. And, you know, for her, it's really been great because you know, we've had, you know, being honest, we had mostly claiming horses through my career. We have sprinkled in the stake horse here and there, but to get one like this for her is really, really has a lot of meaning to me and the whole rest of the family. So, you know, she grew up in up nice Saratoga, so to compete at this kind of a level was really something special for her.
Yeah, you've always said that she's the best horse that you have in the barn. Does she have a little more competition now?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she's got but still, you know, there's got a little more competition, but she's still the best horse. So, yep, she'll hold that position.
Yeah, talking with trainer Butch Reed here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. And if you're just tuning in, fresh off that huge win in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies on Friday, you heard the stretch call as we came on the air. How many times, Butch, have you gone back and watched the replay of the race?
I keep watching that, the whatever they call it, the helmet cam view of it, which I've watched probably 20 times. I haven't really watched. I wanted to take the opportunity to watch. Somebody recorded the whole telecast for me, so I wanted to get a chance to watch, but I haven't been able to do it. But that helmet camp view was just amazing, and you know how courageous she was, and how courageous these jocks are all the time. And if you get an opportunity, people should watch that. If they get an opportunity to watch that bird's eye view of the race, and just how close. I mean, you don't get true appreciation of it standing in the grandstand of how tight that actually was, and for Joelle to push through there, and for a 2-year-old filly to go through there without hesitation was really an amazing thing to see.
Yeah, had she shown you that courage in the mornings too? Where I guess you never know until they're in that position and they do it in the afternoons, but had she shown you that courage that, hey, I'm unflappable and it doesn't matter what you ask me to do, I'm going to do it?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, she's that way around the barn. She's that way in everything she does. I mean, it's hard to duplicate that kind of situation in the morning, you know, especially when, you know, it's a horse who's pretty much faster than the bunch of the 2-year-olds I have. But, you know, she mentally, she is her greatest asset. You know, I just think she doesn't worry about anything. And even Princess Noor kind of was the first to get to her, and he kind of got his elbow out and the stick waving in her face. And, you know, she never flinched. It's amazing to see. And then she went, when Princess Noor kind of eased out a little bit and to her, you know, to squeeze through that hole in the rail was, you know, a real testament to her try and her smarts and her confidence.
Well, trainer Butch Reed started his training career back in the early to mid 80s, and as you heard, has had a tremendous amount of success, multiple greatest stakes winners, a couple of Breeders' Cup wins to his credit now. And when I come back, we're going to talk about the early days of Butch Reed. We'll tell you how he got started, or he'll tell you how he got started, and then we'll walk through some of those other big wins too, because there have been several special moments that he's been able to share with his wife, Virginia, his daughter, Whitney. It has just been a wonderful ride for him, and we'll talk more about that when we come back. It's Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
The Fasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic December Mixed and Horses of Racing Age Sale is the last mixed sale of 2020. Mid-Atlantic December offers quality to buyers at all levels. This year's sale features large groups of weanlings and in-foal mares, and of course, the sale's popular Horses of Racing Age supplemental catalog. Online bidding and phone bidding will be available. The Fasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic December Mixed and Horses of Racing Age Sale, Tuesday, December 8th in Timonium, Maryland. Where will you be?
Well, Fasic's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Fasic Tipton's has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're gonna have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Fasic Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you know, you can't lose.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
On the extreme outside, a fleet again is in there. Baryshnikov is still far back. They come to the top of the lane and Cease goes on. He's leading it by just over a length. Bird Runner's running a huge one. In the center of the track, here's Giant Oak. On the extreme outside, the grey of Fleet again is coming home well as well. They come for home now. It's still wide open. Bird Run on the inside. On the outside, a Fleet again. A Fleet again shifting ground, but he's grinding his way to victory. And it's going to be a Fleet again to win the marathon. A Fleet again pulled clear by nearly two in the end. Bird Run second. Giant Oak was third. And then Pleasant Prince and Cease.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. That was Trevor Denman with the call of the 2011 Breeders' Cup Marathon, and a Fleet again getting the victory. The first of now two Breeders' Cup wins for trainer Butch Reed Jr., who is my special guest on the program this afternoon. If you missed any portion of the show, all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this show and all of our shows at your leisure. They're all there for you, all the way back to our first one with Ron Ellis about 8 or 9 years ago now. They're all there for you. Head back and take a listen. Horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts. I do want to make mention of this. This is Veterans Day, November 11th, and I want to extend a very special thank you to all of the veterans out there who have made sacrifices in so many ways that we can't even imagine to support our country. And this is your day to be recognized. One of the things that came out from owner breeder Tom McGrath in the post-race press conference after the Juvenile Fillies was that Freddie Seitz of Brookdale made the decision to breed the mare to Nyquist. Freddie and his brother Joe, both former Marines, our thanks to them, and I thought it was appropriate to recognize them on this day. And Butch, without Freddie's insight, this whole thing doesn't even happen.
Oh, absolutely not, you know, because I had seen Nyquist. He ran out of my barn when he ran in the Pennsylvania Derby, and I thought he was okay, but to be honest with you, I wasn't that wild about him. So when Freddie and Tom got together and made that decision, I was okay, that sounds okay to me. And obviously, they know better than me because it turned out spectacular.
So. Yeah, it turned out pretty well. So I mentioned at the end of the first half of the show that you took out your trainer's license in, I guess, the mid-'80s and started training at Monmouth Park before moving to Parks about 15 years later. Take me back to the beginning. Where did the journey begin for Butch Reed?
Where it began was at the University of Maryland in College Park, actually. My brother Mark, as everybody knows, was a big trainer here at Parks, but he had started getting involved with the horses. We had we grew up right outside of in South Jersey, right outside of Philadelphia, and had been to the old Garden State. The original Garden State was about 10 minutes from where we were born and grew up. And went to the University of Maryland. I kind of followed his footsteps down there. We were both college wrestlers, actually, and went down there and did a little wrestling down there. But then the horse bug bit, and Mark went to work for Dickie Dutrow right after graduating from college. And then he moved on and came up to Philly here, and I actually went to work in my last 2 years at college for Dutrow, rubbing horses in the morning or walking hots and supposedly going to classes in the afternoon, but mainly hanging out at the racetrack in the afternoon. I'm still amazed how I managed to hang in there long enough to get my degree, but we did manage to do that. So, working for Dickie Dutrow down in Maryland at the Laurel and Bowie and all the tracks that used to be down there. So, upon graduating from college, Mark and I were getting together and we're trying to start a bloodstock thing, and that kind of didn't work out too well. I wasn't really ready for the kind of dedication I don't think that it took to get something like that off the ground. So I actually went to work for Playboy Hotel and Casino in Atlantic City for a few years, got away from the racetrack for a while, and then worked there and was a VIP concierge and guest services manager and limo driver and did about all of it down there for 2 or 3 years and had a great time. But then I think Hefner couldn't get his license in New Jersey, so it was going to close down, and I didn't feel like starting up down there, so starting up at a new place. So my brother called me, and he was just exceeded his max here at Philadelphia Park, or Keystone it was actually back in those days, and was looking to send a small string up to Monmouth, and was looking for somebody to run that, send 10 or 15 horses up to Monmouth Park. And that's where I jumped off and went back into horses full time. Was up there for as assistant for him for a couple of years. Did this old New Jersey circuit where you had to go from Monmouth to the Meadowlands to Garden State in the spring and do it all over again. So lived like a vagabond for a few years, but learned a lot from my brother. And just, you know, to get an opportunity like that to have horses and actually, you know, in horse racing, anybody can tell you anything they want, but until you've experienced it, you don't really learn anything. So Brother Mark gave me that opportunity to have my own little string of horses up there. We've, you know, succeeded and failed along the way. And then met my wife, Virginia, there. She was actually galloping for us, getting on horses for me. And then we came back to Garden State, I think it was maybe 83, something like that. And that's when I went out on my own and got my trainer's license. And fortunately to have a brother like Mark to give me a few horses to train and kind of get started and, you know, get some people, get your name in the program anyway, because that's what it takes to get started. So I can't give my brother Mark enough credit. He really had everything to do with, you know, me getting started and the success I've had in the game.
Yeah, it's a fantastic story. And, you know, it's amazing the way that life takes you on these different paths and eventually you find where you want to be. And that was certainly the case for you, Butch. But where do you think you'd be right now? What do you think you'd be doing if Mark didn't come along and get you back into horse racing? What might Butch Reed be doing?
I couldn't imagine, to tell you the truth. But, you know, I had said at the time, I said, look, I'm going to give this 3 years. You know, I had my little degree from University of Maryland, and I'm going to give this 3 years, give it a shot. And if it doesn't work, you know, I a degree in transportation, so I guess I could have run a trucking company or something along those lines. I'm not even sure, to be exact. But, you know, if he hadn't given me the chance, I'm not sure where I'd be right now. But I know I wouldn't trade it for anything after the – there's been a lot of ups and downs during the ride, but I wouldn't trade it for anything right now, that's for sure.
Your brother Mark has had one heck of a career in his own right, more than 1,700 winners. As a matter of fact, he's closing in on 1,800. And a multiple graded stakes winner himself. What makes Mark such a good trainer?
He got lucky, I think. Mostly lucky. No, I'm kidding. No, he's an intelligent man, and he's, you know, he started out working really hard at it, and he's got a great gift of gab. You know, he's a good hustler, and he's got all the right combinations that it takes to be a successful trainer. And you know, he's aggressive, and, you know, he was aggressive training. That's the one thing I did learn from him early on. You got to be aggressive. You got to win races. I mean, you win races, people take notice. If you're, you know, protecting your horses and not running them in the right spots, you're not going to win races, and you're not going to get noticed. So that was the main thing he imparted to me, was just be aggressive, you know, and run the horses where they can win, and you'll be fine.
He went on quite a ride back in 1990 with Mr. Nickerson. You remember that point in his career?
No, absolutely. Yeah, that was you know highest highs, because that was the first one that really within our operation would really look like he was ready to. Well, he did step up to the national stage and be a real contender. So that was the first time I was already working for him, and first time any of us had experienced anything like that. I'm very fortunate that. We started out driving for the Breeders' Cup that day at Belmont, that horrible day. But fortunately, traffic was too bad, so I turned back. So just as well I wasn't there that day. You know, it was a great ride when it was going. And, you know, he was loving every minute of it. And that was one that really moved us to a different level on the national scene.
Who was the horse that took you to another level and really started to put Butch Reed on the map?
Well, actually, I was kind of kicking around at Monmouth Park with four or five horses of my own, not doing a whole lot. And then I happened to be in the end of the barn with Joe Pierce. And Joe Pierce and I became friendly, and he turned a guy on to me named Sidney Bear. and Mr. Bear's horses. I picked up, I think I was kicking around with four or five horses, and I got Mr. Bear's horses that year and came back to Monmouth, and there was a horse named Gross Carr in that group who just won. He won, I believe, five stakes as a three-year-old. That was my first graded stakes win. He won the Lamplighter, I believe it was, and the Choice Handicap at Monmouth. And we just we had a great Monmouth meet, and then other horses, Naz Game, Frozen Runway, just he gave me a whole barn full of runners. So it was Sidney Barrett's horses was our first opportunity. Unfortunately, Mr. Barrett did like to move his horses around a little bit. So that was the first year we went to Gulfstream Park, and I believe we shipped down there with 21 horses, and nobody could believe it because I was right in the middle of the old Millionaires Row at Gulfstream. Shug McGay, he was on one side, and Neil Harrod was splitting the barn with me, and Rusty Arnold and all the and Sonny Hine and all the big-time guys were right in there, and I was like a shock to my system to be in there and with those big guys. And then my daughter was born that year, so my daughter was 6 months old, and it was our first year at Gulfstream, and we had shelled out a lot of money for a place to live. And we were down there with 21 horses, 18 of them belonging to Mr. Bear. And first horse I ran, unfortunately, was Gross Carr, who had won like five stakes the previous year and was our main reason for being down there. And unfortunately, the first time I ran him, he got injured. So I got my first real lesson in horse racing. I went from having 21 horses and, being in Millionaire's Road and our Gulfstream to coming in the next morning. I had 18 empty stalls and three horses, so with a six-month-old baby and a whole lot of rent to pay. So that was my first true glimpse into horse racing. I got a real feel for it that day. So,
was there a point, Butch, at that moment, did you think, okay, maybe that trucking company is a pretty good idea?
Yeah. Well, I just remember me and my wife standing there hugging, looking at the empty stalls, but tears rolling down our face. Like, what are we going to do now? You know, so. But we somehow managed to scramble through, and it took years from there, but we slowly got momentum back. And I think the horse that really gave us our reemergence, a horse named Evil Bear. I don't know if anybody remembers him, but yeah. A very fast horse that a friend of mine, Joseph Beeney, had given not a whole lot of money for. But he ran and said, you know, he won the Boojum up at Aqueduct and ran second in the True North. And was actually second in the King's Bishop up at Saratoga. So he was the kind of horse he was the reason that got us into New York, and we're competitive in the stakes up there. He's probably the top two or three sprinters in the country at that time. So he was another horse that really got us back in the game and got us rolling, got us some recognition.
I know you learned a lot from your brother Mark, but you just mentioned some other big names. Being there with notable trainers like Shug McGahey and Sonny Hine and Neil Howard, were there other trainers that you would go to and pick their brain, or at least try to watch the way they handled their business and try to model yourself in that fashion too?
Yeah, well, you know, I was thinking about that not that long ago. As a matter of fact, I think about, you know, being at Gulfstream and guys like Jimmy Kroll. I was in the barn actually with Jimmy Kroll for a while when he had Holy Bull and Sonny Hine, like I said, and Alan Jerkins has always been a hero of mine. You know, those guys really train the racehorse, you know, and that's why I think sometimes here at Parks, these guys look at me a little funny because I train probably a little more old school, a little harder probably than a lot of these current day and age guys do. But from watching those guys, watching a Jimmy Kroll and watching Alan Jerkins, you know, those horses went out there and they galloped and they were big and strong and they breezed and they would have a good mile and a half happy gallop every day. Where now you do that stuff around here, people look at you like you're crazy because they go out and jog a mile, most of them. So, but, you know, to get a horse and, like, we just accomplished a horse, you know, to run a mile on a 16th, I believe you got to train them. So that's where I kind of, I don't know, say I copied the style, but, and they weren't really my mentors, but just observing them and watching our horses train every day is just invaluable service. And I tell anybody now who wants to be a trainer, you got to go where those guys are. You know, you got to go to the Saratogas, you got to go to Gulfstream and just see how they do it, you know, and see how classily they, if that's a word, you know, they run their operations and the attention to detail. And you got to train them, you know, you got to train, you got to lean on them a little bit sometimes, which is, I think, you know, gotten away from horse racing in this day and age a little bit.
Yeah, you mentioned some of the more legendary names in the sport with, you know, Jimmy Kroll and, of course, certainly Alan Jerkins and some of the greatest that have ever chosen this profession. Why do you think, Butch, that things have changed with the approach to training horses? Why have we seen such a shift in the way that it's done today?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, an hour isn't long enough to really explain that, but my theory on it is, you know, it's the way they treat the young horses now. You know, it used to be like Calumet, you see 100 yearlings running across the field, you know, and they'd get each other sick and they'd kick each other and bite each other, and those horses were much tougher. You know, I think horses in this day and age with the value of any of these possible horses, I mean, people are just aren't willing to take, you know, one little scratch or one little bump in the wrong place. But one of these horses headed to the yearling sale could cost somebody millions. So I don't think the horses are given enough opportunity anymore as young horses to get roughed up, to go ahead, get out there in the field and mix it up with the other horses. So they don't, and, you know, as soon as a horse coughs, because you can't have them sick at the wrong time either. If you're sick up to the date of a sale, you know, you're going to blow the whole sale. So, you know, the veterinarians are in there with tons of antibiotics and stuff like that, which, you know, I just don't think the horses build the constitution that they used to in the old days where you could stand up to that kind of training. You got to really treat these horses in this day and age with much more kid gloves than you were able to in the past. And I think it's unfortunate, too, by the way. So.
Yeah, well, we talked in the first half of the program about Gary Barber and the fact that he's now going to have a farm in Pennsylvania. He'll have yearlings there and his younger horses, and he's going to give you some of his babies to train. That's a great thing, but do you have to at some point have a conversation with Gary and say, listen, this is my approach. This is the way that I believe in bringing young horses along, just to make sure that you and your owners are on the same page philosophically?
Absolutely, and, you know, and that's probably coming up pretty soon because the yearlings are starting to get broke, you know, get broke right now. So that's a discussion we'll have. But, you know, he runs a first-class operation, and he's always interested and will listen to your opinion. The short time that I've known the man, he's just in it for the joy, and he really loves his horses and wants to make sure they're getting nothing but first-class care, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's fantastic because you told the story about, you know, losing the horses when you got to Gulfstream and looking at the 18 empty stalls the very next day after they were all full, and what that was like having a new baby and all those kinds of things. Well, Gary Barber mentioned in the press conference after VeQuist won the other day that, you know, this has been a tough year for everybody, but a tough year for him. He wasn't winning a ton of races like he's used to, and certainly not the big races. And here you are, somebody who was in that position, sort of, and now being able to bring him up to the top, and you know, that's got to be pretty cool too.
Oh, it's a great feeling. You know, a guy like that who's been a legend or is a legend in sport, and he appreciates it so much. You know, he enjoys it and he appreciates it. And I love being able to, you know, get some things done for a guy like that. And Adam Wachtel is the same. Me and Tom McGrath, they all, you know, and Tom, this is, you know, he had been on the, you know, and he's only owned horses about 10 years, and he's already met, already had Alfred Vanderbilt handing him a trophy, and now he's a few short years later winning a Breeders' Cup race. So it's just great. You know, that gives you a warm feeling deep down inside that know that you had something to do with giving these guys that kind of joy. So it makes it all worthwhile.
Let's talk about some of the other top horses that you've been around, and earlier we mentioned the name Maximus Mischief. Tell me a little bit more about him.
Well, Max came in. It was a horse we bought at the Timonium 2-year-old training sale. It was actually Chuck Zagney's son, of Chuck Zagney of Cassius King Stable, everybody knows. And it was his son, Alex, who was first caught his eye down at the sale. And he said, hey, come over and look at this one. So we all went over and looked at him, and we certainly liked him, and he vetted and all that stuff, and we got lucky enough to get him purchased. And he was just, you know, he was a different horse from day one when he came into the racetrack. I had never really had my hands on a horse quite like that, and I don't know if anybody really has for that matter, but he was just an amazing horse, big and athletic, you know, and just, you know, did everything right. And unfortunately, it was his size probably that ended up leading to his little bit of getting hurt, because you know, as a two-year-old, he was already over 1,200 pounds, so he was a big, strong guy, but very nimble, you know, very, very athletic. And we had, after his win in the Remsen, we were, you know, very excited and ready to move forward. But, you know, unfortunately, he had to have that minor injury. But now, actually, my wife went over and I didn't get an opportunity, but went over and saw him, and he said he looks fantastic, and his little injury is all healed up, and he looks great, and he's running around in the field. And my wife is, I don't know if you know, is a tremendous cookie eater. She feeds these little cookies or cookie feeder. And Max, even though we hadn't seen him in a couple of years, recognized her right away and was begging for cookies right away. So, Max really got off to a great start in his stallion career. Like they were saying, he got 190 mares last spring. So, everybody else is real, you know, real excited about him too. So I think he'll have a great career in his next career. So.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Are there things that, since you were on the Derby trail with him, are there things, Butch, that you can take away from that experience and now maybe apply it to VQuest? Are there any similarities there or things that you can work in to help you as you try to get ready for a race like the Kentucky Oaks in April?
Well, I think it already has helped. You know, the horses at this level try enough. So you have to give them plenty of time between races. That's the one thing that I've learned, you know, keep their races spaced out because they try hard. And even though after the race they come back bouncing and look like they're okay, you have to give them plenty of opportunity. And, you know, you have to do all the right stuff. You have to make sure their feeding program is good, and you have to make sure that, you know, they're getting everything that they need. And, you know, that's the main thing that I've learned from being with Max is just the attention to details and being on top of him and keeping his races well-spaced.
Yeah, it certainly makes sense. Butch Reed Jr., my special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Let me throw another name at you since you mentioned Alfred G. Vanderbilt and that Grade 1 win. That was back in 2012. Up until this year, that was the lone Grade 1 win on your resume. Now you have two more to add to it. Poseidon's Warrior taking the A.G. Vanderbilt in 2012. How special was he?
Oh, fantastic. I mean, he was just a tremendous, not a very big horse. He was a little bit of a, you know, a little on the smaller side. And he had some physical issues, but he was absolutely the toughest horse I ever had. And to this day, he's still the toughest. He'd run through, you know, run over broken glass. He just loved to run. And I don't even know if he was the most talented or fastest horse I ever had, but he would outgut him. And if you look at his race and get an opportunity to see the replay in the Vanderbilt, it's, tongue's hanging out of the side of his mouth, but he is just digging in and getting out a little bit. But he always did that from day one, you know. So he was just a trier. That's all I can tell. And now I'm fortunate enough to have some of his offspring, and they're all just like him, kind of nondescript horses, not real big and not real broad, but just triers. They all like to get the job done, and they appreciate it, and they all, you know, very, very solid horses.
Does it help a trainer when you have a horse that you trained and now you get to train their babies? Does it help in any way to have knowledge of the sire or even the dam, for example?
Well, I was thrown a little bit off. Maybe I had too much knowledge on this one because, you know, now I'm drawing a blank. Poseidon was a total sprinter. I mean, we stretched him 7/8 a couple times in the Bosberg, and he was second. But he really couldn't, you know, his best distance was 6 furlongs. And now his babies, I mean, I figured they all had to be sprinters. We've been sprinting, and now I run a couple of them long, and they have all won going around the ground. So I don't know if I had too much information on that one or not, but finally it looks like his babies want to go long, which is kind of surprising. But
wow.
That's the way it works out sometimes.
Yeah, wow, that's just incredible. So, Butch, there's about 4 minutes or so left, maybe 3.5 minutes before we have to wind down the program. If I walk into Butch Reed's house and I see some of the racing memorabilia that you have, outside of the ones that we've talked about so far, maybe those are appropriate for your answer too, but what types of things am I going to see? Wind pictures, trophies, saddle towels, anything like that?
Oh, yeah, down in the man cave, yeah, you're going to see the wind, you know, actually – as we've kind of moved up a level or two, some of the older ones are kind of dropping off, but some of all my favorites are still up there. The horse Evil Bear was an absolute favorite, and I've got one. I've got a Mike Smith win picture from a stake down at Gulfstream Park. Mike looks like he's about 18 years old in there. I'm not sure how old he was, but he looks like a young guy in there. But there's you know, definitely in it. You know, I think back to my first winner. It was a horse named Rock Lives back in Monmouth Park, the first for Trez Van Stabel. Trez Van Stabel, who were the original Sheets guys, the original Rags and Sheets guys. There's been so many, you know, good things along the way that we've kept and been able to keep memorabilia. And every once in a while I get a chance to go through and reflect on them. But, you know, it's a very up-and-down business. But main thing is keep an even keel. Never get too high on yourself when you're rolling good, and never get too low when things aren't quite going as well. So that's the hardest part about this business, just keeping an even keel and keep pushing forward.
You mentioned the fact that both you and your brother, Mark, were college wrestlers. So I always like to wind the program down by asking trainers to let me know something about them that we haven't talked about yet. Maybe other hobbies and interests. Are you still into wrestling, or are there other sports that you follow or things like that?
Well, I follow sports, but no, I'm not, you know, I'm not involved too much anymore, but I love it, watching it. I shouldn't say that, but we had a perfect weekend. My brother said it was the greatest trifecta you would have never thought happened. Joe Biden wins the election. I win a Breeders' Cup race, and Maryland beats Penn State in football. So that was the trifecta for the weekend, and we never thought we'd see happen. So.
Fantastic. Well, Butch, listen, it has been such a delight to look back on the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies with you and to look back on your career. And all the best moving forward. Let's get her to April and get her there sound and healthy, and let's make a big run at that Kentucky Oaks.
Well, thanks for having me, and it's been a pleasure talking to y'all, and we'll look forward to what's coming up in the spring.
All right, thanks, Butch. All the best moving forward. Butch Reed, my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Yeah, just fantastic. Great story. And you talk about a story of perseverance. Here's a guy that when his daughter is born, what did he say, 6 months old? He loses all the horses in his barn. They have to go back to square one pretty much and start building up his business again. Fantastic. And here he is with his second Breeders' Cup win. Congratulations to Butch, to his wife Virginia, to Teresa, his assistant, the entire team, his daughter Whitney. Well done. Keep it rolling. All right, if you missed any portion of the show, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast. For my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studio, for Butch Reed Jr., I'm Mike Pennell. We'll talk to you next week on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.